This is Deanna Spingola. It is Friday, December 21st, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Diana Hunter. Her website is naturecons.weebly.com. And Weebly is spelled Weebly.com. NatureCons, NatureCons. And that will, of course, be linked on the website. Welcome to the program, Diana.
Thank you, Deanna. It's great to be back with you. It's been a long time, so I'm glad to be here.
I am very happy to be chatting with you again, and I know that you have been on other RBN programs and other venues, and so you've also developed a website since we talked last, and it's beautiful. It is a very, very nice website.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's a lot of work on there.
Yes.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, when I first started my website, I was primarily involved in what the environmentalists were taking from us and the whole Agenda 21 program. And since then, it's evolved into a lot of different segments as I have found out actually who is really behind the UN Agenda 21 and the environmentalists, which at that time I did not know. So it's done a lot. The website's done a lot of evolving.
Good. Well, I'm just going to let you take it away. I think you wanted to talk about the protocols and Agenda 21 and the connection between the two, which I'm really looking forward to having you share this information.
Right. As I was saying before about the environmentalists and the UN, there's so much information out there now about Agenda 21 and what groups like Nature Conservancy and World Wildlife are doing. But what really surprised me, when I kept doing research, I knew there had to be somebody at the head of the UN. I mean, it doesn't make sense for all of these people that are exposing UN Agenda 21 to just stop with that. And so through thousands of hours of research, and I must say, Deanna, a large part of it was due to you and your work on the Zionism, I finally realized who was behind all of this, and it is the Zionist Talmudic Jews, and I'm saying that they are absolutely behind Agenda 21, and I'm really wondering why people don't bring that out more. I did a search on both Yahoo and Google, and I don't know that I brought up any of the main Agenda 21 groups that are exposing this.
Well, I think that most things that I've ever studied about, most issues that I've studied, when you really go deeply and see who is behind it, even if we're talking about, for instance, organ harvesting, and then you look at the people who designed or created a new category for brain death at Harvard back in 1969, now have not discovered the committee, the people on the committee. But I know I'm going to find a Jew there. I just know that.
I think they're behind every place that I'm looking at. At least they seem to be. And what is amazing, now I had looked and I've heard about the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. I've been listening to that and looking at that for quite a while. But unfortunately, I had only been looking, for instance, now with Brother Nathaniel, I have his videos and articles are all over my website, and he has a great one about the protocols. But however, in saying that, I had never really sat down and read all of them before. I don't know why, I just didn't. And then it hit me and I thought, how are the protocols related to Agenda 21? So I found a great site that I've got linked onto my page with the protocols, and I started looking through them. Now, just for instance.
Okay, where say, I'm at your site right now. Where would I look? Agenda Nature Conservancy and Agenda 21?
I have one that says Zionism is the problem, and when it scrolls out the way it does when you put your mouse
mm-hmm,
over it,
mm-hmm.
It's got Blueprint for New World Order.
Okay.
And I have connected. It's got some things with Brother Nathaniel on there, and then right underneath his videos, it's got the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, and it's got the full text of it. And that, I believe, somebody, I think from Australia, it's BibleBelievers.org, did a tremendous job of putting them all up there. And so I don't have the full text. I just have a link to it.
Okay.
What I found, especially with Agenda 21, and I am working on an article or maybe a series of articles, I'm going to try to link all of the protocols to what is going on today so that people can see each item, because there's 24 and there's quite a few items to each protocol. However, back to addressing Agenda 21, I found in protocol number 6, item number 4, and it says, we need not take into account, but as landed proprietors, they can still be harmful to us. Now they're talking about us, Segoyim, from the fact that they are self-sufficing in the resources upon which they live. It is essential, therefore, for us at whatever cost to deprive them of their land. This object will be best attained by increasing the burdens upon landed property in loading lands with debts. These measures will check landholding and keep it in a state of humble and unconditional submission. Now, if that isn't Agenda 21 with all of the zoning and the land grabs, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
And plus loading it with debts. So that brings in all of the mortgages and things of that nature. And it was just amazing to me, Deanna, what a blueprint the protocols are for the whole New World Order. And why aren't more people bringing this out? I don't understand it.
Because people don't think critically. And they don't piece things together. They don't look at one issue. Oftentimes they look at one issue without looking at the whole of a thing. They don't think, oh, well, if this is connected to this and this is connected to that, and they're just looking at one issue. And everybody has their, it's like plunking only one key on the piano. You keep plunking that one key, you're not going to get a whole song. You have to incorporate all the keys, the black and the white keys on the piano, in order to bring the harmony into any kind of a understanding. And so the more that one does that, the more that they will be able to hear the whole story, or the whole melody, the whole song.
Well, I think that's a good point. And I think what really needs to be done is to have an item-by-item list of each of these protocols and the separate items underneath it and how they relate to what's going on with this. Because it tells you, they tell you exactly what they're going to be doing. And just for the people who try to say they're a forgery, well, I know a lot of people have said that. They are. When people read these, they will know exactly what is going on in the world today. I highly think that after I read all of the protocols, if you read nothing else except these 24 protocols, you will know what's going on in the world and who's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a history 101 for me. And it was just such an eye-opener. And besides a few other things that I wanted to touch on, if it's okay,
sure.
Besides Agenda 21 on here, I found on protocol number 9, Christian youth destroyed. And the item is number 10. We have fooled, bemused, and corrupted the youth of the Goyim by rearing them in principles and theories which are known to us to be false, incalculated. The protocol number 10, they have poison of liberalism. We named the presidents. Well, what is that telling us? We know what liberalism, how it has affected the country, but how many people know who started it?
Certainly. And Lenin also said some time ago that they would control both sides of any issue, meaning whether you're talking about the right or the left, whether you're talking about the Zionist Jews or the Marxist Jews. The Marxist Jews control the left, and the Zionist Jews control the right. And they seem to come to it, at it from a different perspective. But basically, the results are always the same.
Right. And then we've got protocol number 14, we shall forbid Christ. If people can't connect that, you know, years ago when I was actually still watching Fox News, I used to listen to Bill O'Reilly's rant about the fight against Christmas, and I thought, oh, that's a good topic to bring up. However, as we both know, Deanna, he stopped just short of saying who really did it. Well, when you read these protocols, you will see that. And then we have protocol number 15 about the secret societies. And I did a whole section on secret societies on my website. I put all this information up. And it wasn't until I read the protocols that I find out who's behind the secret societies. I mean, it is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of secret societies are you thinking?
Well, for one thing, the Shriners and the Masons.
Okay. And if you look at who the Shriners and who the Freemasons, who they have also sponsored, including the Boy Scouts.
No, I did not know that. I didn't know that they sponsored the Boy Scouts.
Mm-hmm. I do believe they did. And any time that you have an organization that promotes the wearing of medals or the wearing of or doing things to earn badges and that kind of thing, you think, that's so militaristic. Don't you think?
Yes, considering I used to be in the Girl Scouts and I had a lot of badges and things like that. Now you got me wondering about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's probably the same thing. But the guy, Lord Baden-Powell, was a Freemason, and he created the Boy Scouts of America. He was actually a Brit, or as Veronica Clark would say, he was a Britzy. So if you look at that, then you think, see, what better way can you have of really influencing the youth? We think of music, we think of media, but what did they use before that? I mean, before the video games came along, children were going to Cub Scout meetings and they were going to Girl Scouts and that kind of thing.
Well, I do know. Because I spent a lot of time in the Girl Scouts, and I must say I enjoyed it. We did a lot of camping and things like that. However, in looking, I don't even know what I was researching, but I came across something about the Girl Scouts and how they have been changed now. And it is terrible. I wouldn't recommend it for any small child, neither the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts. It's completely changed from when I was in it. And that's a shame. You can see where this has evolved, even into those groups.
Sure. Well, I think it's you know, you have an organization and you have to have a very, well, like the young, the YMCA, the YWCA, that also has Freemasonic foundation. And you can't start out with what you want it to end up as. You have to have it be humanitarian or have some beneficial aspects of it so that you attract people. And then just gradually you just change it so that you meet your objectives. But you can't start by having your objectives obvious, because then people say, oh gosh, do you know who's behind this? You know what they're doing? You know what their objectives are? So you have to start, you know, behind some sort of a, another stage, behind some sort of something that nobody will suspect.
Oh, and they're brilliant at doing that. I brilliantly evil.
Mm-hmm.
They are. I mean, they have been able to finagle us. Now I understand why a lot of people have told me that Americans are so naive. I understand that now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very sad and a hurtful thing to know that the entire rest of the world knows how we're being manipulated and we're the last ones to know.
Yes.
You know, and getting back to the secret societies, Deanna, because I have put up, I have a section on the Pilgrim Society and the 1001 Club connection, which connects, that's the Nature, the 1001 Club Nature Trust connects right back up to the World Wildlife Fund and all the green ones, the green groups. So it's kind of come full circle on this.
Right. And the Pilgrim Society is something that hardly anybody ever addresses. And there's only one book that I'm aware of on this, and it was sanctioned by the Pilgrim Society itself. Let's see, I can't think of the name of that book, but definitely it's an amazing book. I'll have to look at it here. And I got it through the library, and The Pilgrim Society, A Study of the Anglo-American Establishment by Joel van der Raijen, Institute for the Study of Globalism and Covert Politics, July 2008. Oh, here's the real one, the one that was sanctioned by the Pilgrim Society itself, and it's called The Pilgrims of Great Britain, A Centennial History of by Anne Pemlott Baker, Profile Books, London, England, and the copyright is held by the Pilgrims of Great Britain.
I have not heard of that book that you were talking about, but I'm definitely going to look into it. On my side, and I had been doing a lot of reading of it, Charles Savoy.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. I reference him, too.
Isn't he wonderful with this?
Yes.
And people do need to realize, because it isn't, they need to see that British Israel is such a big part of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's not just Israel, per se, as a country, or the Zionist, the Zionism. They need to see how it still connects to Britain and the whole British Israeli group. And Charles Savoy has done a magnificent job on bringing this out.
Right. And, of course, I think the reason that you have Britain involved to begin with is because that's the first country that the Jews were so successful in taking over as early as beginning in 1694.
Right. I keep going back, and I know you do too. I've heard you say it 100 times, that if people do not know history, they're not going to know all of this.
Right. So I think it's important that we know our history.
And two, I've got a page up on the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and how the Jews have really, you know, they are a group that is sponsored by all the Jews, to my understanding, and what I've looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, people are not, they're bringing a lot of this out about these groups, but they're not bringing out who is behind all of them.
Right.
I think it would probably be easier, Deanna, to find groups that are not sponsored by Jewish people, don't you think?
I'm not sure we'd be very successful in finding any.
That's what I meant. It would be a lot quicker to go the reverse way with it.
Right.
I mean, this is just amazing to me.
Well, that's even true when you're looking behind who started the American Medical Association, behind the American Dental Association, behind if you even look at who started the FDA, the person that wrote the book about the need for food safety, and you're going to find a socialist. He wrote The Jungle, Sinclair Lewis. No, not it wasn't Sinclair Lewis. It was Upton Sinclair.
You're right. And they have then way back, I was doing research about illegal immigration when I really first started this, until it made me so upset I just couldn't do it anymore. And so who do I find out from one of Brother Nathaniel's articles that was really behind the 1965 open floodgates of our immigration? Senator Jacob Javits was the head one on there.
Right. He was working for Teddy Kennedy, right?
Yes. And there were three other ones. I can't remember the names exactly right now. But they were all Jewish, the senators and congressmen that really pushed that illegal immigration through. And there again, Deanna, I get a few newsletters from groups fighting illegal immigration. Do I see one thing about who is really behind pushing this? No, I don't.
And if you go back even further, you will find people, Emma Lays, she wrote the, Emma, I got to find it here. See, I don't remember things that I can look up. My theory is if you can look it up, you don't have to commit it to memory.
And I just find that after a while, your brain gets so overwhelmed with it, or at least mine does, that I can't keep it all quite straight.
Right. Emma Lazarus. She was the daughter of Moshe Lazarus, a wealthy New York sugar merchant, was a descendant of early Jewish settlers during the colonial period. She wrote articles about the pogroms in Russia and helped immigrants learn practical skills to enable them to secure employment. In 1882, hordes immigrated from the Russian Pale, that's the Pale of Settlement, to New York. She began promoting the formation of a Jewish homeland in the mid-1880s, over a decade before Theodore Herzl assumed the leadership of the Zionist movement. In 1883, she wrote the poem The New Colossus, which in 1903 officials had engraved on a bronze plaque and mounted inside the Statue of Liberty. And she is the one that said, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." Okay, so basically she's saying, hey, we don't care if you can work, if you're homeless, you're poor, come on in. And this is communism's deceptive dogma. In other words, it's a tool of the wealthy. It appeals to the poor and the wretched and the homeless. And America opened its doors to some of the very people who promoted communism and to the oppressed peoples who would unhesitatingly accept it, even though they relocated to a free, supposedly free country. And that was back in 1882 that the Jewish immigrants started coming in, and the first immigration laws were actually created in 1920, and they were created by a Jew. And they had political ramifications and political objectives that were designed to to facilitate the political objectives that the Jew had, and to encourage indiscriminate immigration, which created a lot of crime and chaos, and led to multiculturalism.
Oh yes, and the I'm sure you've seen that video by Barbara Spector talking
oh,
about.
Oh yes. Oh, I just want to slap her.
Yes, I agree. I am not a violent person, Deanna. I have never hurt anybody or done anything violent in my life. But boy, that woman just, and she's so condescending about it.
Yeah. She says, you know, people are going to discover that the Jews are behind a lot of this, and there's going to be some people that might be mad at us. But then she goes on to say, but we're going to do it anyway because it needs to be done. Oh! Oh!
Yes, she is. She is something, isn't she?
She really is.
And I read something just the other day too that I found very interesting, that the Jewish people are the only ones that refuse to answer the census. That according, and I believe it's even to today, that the census does not have a really good count of the Jewish people in this country because they have always refused to answer it.
Interesting.
I don't remember where I saw it, but yes, I had heard that.
Right. Now, the last census that's available, there's a 72-year privacy issue, and the last census that I'm aware of that came out was 1930. Let's see, 1940 should be, maybe that was released this year, because that would be 60. Yeah, 1940 would be the most recent census. And I don't know that they have a religious category. They have an ethnic category. At least they did in 1930, where you can answer what your ethnicity is. But with the Jewish mentality, they can identify themselves by race or by religion. I mean, there are certainly people who've converted to Judaism who can't obviously convert their ethnic background just because they embrace a different religion. And so there's a fine line between race and ethnicity.
Right, and it just seems to meld all into one. It seems like if they want to use it for under a racial category, they'll use it that way. And then, of course, I even hate to bring up the phrase anti-Semitic.
Well,
because I'm so tired of hearing of that, Deanna. But you know, of course, that seems to be the overall thing that they can stop anybody with it, or they try. They think they can stop anyone with that phrase.
Well, Amy Goodman had an official from the Israeli state, and the name of the little video was called "We Use It All the Time: Anti-Semitism. We Use It All the Time." But it's kind of interesting that Amy Goodman is also Jewish, very leftist, and in fact, apparently she had a romantic interlude or entanglement with Jeremy Scahill, who wrote the book about Blackwater. And you will note that when Jewish people do target certain things, certain issues, for instance, Scahill's book was about Blackwater, but you don't find, and certainly Blackwater was a military group, a private military organization that took over a lot of the contracts from the military. But they always seem to leave out some really important stuff. They leave out the real culprits behind a lot of things. For instance, take Tarpley's work. And he talks about terrorism in the United States and all kinds of things. But he never mentions the J word.
Most of them don't.
Right.
And there again, I mean, we would be so much farther along if they would just come out and say it. I was getting back to the protocols just really quickly because I had left one out on protocol number 2. It's talking about destructive education. And it's under item number 3, and it says, do not suppose for a moment that these statements are empty words. Think carefully of the successes we arranged for Darwinism, parentheses, evolution, Marxism, parentheses, communism, Nietzscheism, parentheses, socialism. To us Jews, at any rate, it should be plain to see what a disintegrating importance these directives have upon the minds of the goyim. So then we get in, and the whole takedown of our education that has been so prevalent in their success.
Right, and then when you look back to the foundation, which would start with the foundation, which was the educational foundation, which Rockefeller started, and according to Stephen Birmingham's book, The Grandees, The Story of America's Sephardic Elite, the Rockefellers were Jewish. And he's
well,
the one.
Absolutely, they were.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? Do I want to say Rothbaum or something like that? I can't remember the exact name that it was supposed to have been changed from.
I don't know, but definitely they certainly changed education, and then in company with Carnegie. Carnegie was supposed to take over the world educational apparatus, and Rockefeller would take care of the domestic educational apparatus, and they did a really good job.
Right, and then all of their foundations. We know that Carnegie and then Mellon, well, Carnegie, when I was doing a lot of the research on for who was connected with Nature Conservancy and World Wildlife Fund, I kept running into the Carnegie Foundation all the time. So it always comes full circle, doesn't it?
It does. And they all sit on the same, they sit on the boards of all of these companies. It is amazing how much power they do have.
Another video I was watching about the protocols, and I hadn't made this connection quite yet, but thank goodness for this one video. Anyway, again, under protocol number 3, and it's item number 11, and it says, Jews will be safe. And then when you connect that with 9/11, I mean, this I'll have to send you this video of it. I don't know if you've seen it or not before. But I thought, well, of course, that makes perfect sense. They were going to make sure that they were protected. And I believe it was, what, maybe 2 or 3 Jews were in the World Trade Center at that time.
Right. It's also interesting that they are always the first people that are whisked away when they know a war is coming. I'm trying to think of some of the countries that, for instance, with Russia protected them, I can't cite the book that I was reading because I have this horrible habit of reading several books at the same time. And I'm trying to remember where I think maybe it was in Sanning's book where he was talking about how they are usually the first that leave a country. Well, for instance, you saw it in Germany. Most of the wealthy people, the wealthy Jews left the country in 1933, before or just after Hitler came to power, and in just you know they're the ones that leave. In fact, look at in our own country, look at the Jews who have gone over to China. They're living in China, or they're living somewhere else, or they're living in South America. And of course, they don't publish a list of these things, but if a country is targeted for war, whether it's economic or military war, the Jews always leave before that occurs. And so, knowing that Germany was targeted for for military action, the Jews left. And then to make it look like, you know, blame somebody else, project it onto somebody else, they'll say, well, you know, Hitler killed all these Jews, when in fact, most of them left.
Right. And one thing that I found interesting, I know people in England, and at one point I was talking, and boy, the people in Europe and England will tell you the truth about the whole Jewish culture. And they must have thought I was from Mars, because I, at that point, and this has been years ago, and I said, well, you know, what is the problem? I don't understand it. And they looked at me truthfully, Deanna, like I had two heads. And they said, oh, you really don't know, do you? And so one interesting story is they were telling me about how when in London, and really the surrounding areas where a lot of the British people were evacuating their children before the Blitz, and how a lot of Jewish people just refused to go. They had the chance to take their children out, and they didn't do it. Now, that's from people that actually survived the whole Blitz in London. This was their story about it. And they said that the Jewish people were just so sure that nobody was going to do anything to them.
Right.
And I thought, boy, that would... And then they have the nerve to say anything about, well, this happened to our children. Well, they had the chance to get them out, like so many English people did, and they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Germany, getting back to Germany, the safest place in Germany to be was either in the Jewish hospital in Berlin, which was virtually untouched, even though they destroyed the entire city of Berlin. It was perfectly safe. The other places to be were in the concentration camps. If you wanted to be safe, that's where you would go.
Now, that I've never heard before. I mean, I know the whole aspect of, what do they call it, the holo-hoax, I guess.
Right.
But I've never heard that if you wanted to be safe, that's where you went.
Yeah, that's where you went.
Isn't that amazing that somebody, I always think, what kind of evil minds would think up something like this?
Exactly. And,
you know, Deanna, I think that's part of the problem why it is so hard for people to get their heads around the truth of it.
Because we can't conceive of such evil.
No, we can't. I mean, it is very hard. But I will say one thing. Just a few weeks ago when Palestine won their... it was what, not statehood, but from the UN. What
right.
was it? Their upgraded status, I'll put it that way,
because
I can't remember exactly what it was. I've been following a lot of the articles on the Internet, primarily because I wanted to see what the comments are. And you know, Deanna, there really is hope, because if you take out the Israeli trolls on there making their comments and just read what Americans are saying, I have never in my memory seen as many people that want to absolutely have nothing to do with Israel.
Right.
It is amazing, and it gives one hope.
And you also talk about this on your website. You mention stoptheblankcheck.org.
Yes, and that's something that I just found, but I'm really going to be trying to push it, because it's AmericansNew.org,
right.
Which is a wonderful website. And this program, I don't know how long it's been out since I just found it, but people can sign up online, and what it does is any politician that is running on a platform and means it, not just saying the words, to cut all financial aid, to cut everything off from Israel, when you sign this check, then you are saying, yes, you will get my vote, but only if you hold to your values, that we are cutting off all of the financial aid, all of the military aid to Israel. And I think that's a big step in the right direction, don't you?
I do, but it brings up the the issue that 300, wasn't it 300 Congress people signed a letter to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton pledging their loyalty to Israel. You remember when they did that?
Now, I don't remember it quite that way. I remember what Cynthia McKinney has said about it. And that was back in, the 90s when she was in a congresswoman. But it's the same thing that they have to make a pledge to Israel. And that's why the blank check thing, the way I'm seeing it is that it would completely clear out Congress. That we'd well, don't you think?
Indeed. Yes, it would clear out Congress for sure. But it was 300 members of the House of Representatives, at 69%, signed a letter addressed to Secretary of State Clinton affirming, and I quote, the unbreakable bond that, unquote, that exists between the United States and the State of Israel. Given that fact, I hardly think that the, and I was talking about Sharia law, I did this little article, because people keep pushing this nonsense about how how the Muslims are taking over the United States and trying to impose Sharia law. In fact, there was an article on News with Views today about that, and I just kind of chuckled. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that brings up those comments I was telling you about on the articles that I've been reading. Now, most of them are really, most of the people that are commenting know, they get it. They know what's going on. But you'll have, I think I saw two or three people that are saying, well, you know what the Muslims are doing. You know what they did with box cutters on 9/11.
Yeah, sure.
And I just want to tell them, you know, if you truly think that a couple of people with box cutters could, in the first place, there are a lot of men on those flights. And if you're telling me that American men and women can't grab a bunch of box cutters from people, if that was the way it was going, just hypothetically, then we're a nation in trouble.
Indeed.
And, you know, if a few Muslims supposedly in an airplane with box cutters can bring our Department of Defense to a standstill, then we've got an even bigger problem. But these people don't think about that.
Right. What a shame.
You know, I mean, and instead of Sharia law, and I know that's what they're doing, this fear mongering or what. I love the term fear porn, because that's exactly what it is.
That is cute.
You know, they better be more afraid of the Noahide laws,
which have already been passed.
Wasn't that 1991?
Yeah, 91, 92. Mm-hmm.
And when you put that together, isn't it the Noahide laws that say that people can be decapitated?
Yes, for idolatry. And idolatry would be worshiping Jesus Christ.
Right. And so when people start asking or saying, talking about the guillotine supposedly in the FEMA camps, gee, is there a connection there? Or could there be a connection there?
Maybe.
You know,
I wonder.
Well, that's what I thought, Deanna, when I was thinking about it. And I was reading over the Noahide laws, which are, some of these things are just so difficult to read. And when I started looking at decapitation, I thought, oh, well, you know, that could really explain a lot about the guillotines, couldn't it?
Yes, indeed.
And isn't that a scary thought?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I mean, that just puts it all in perspective. And no, I don't agree, you know, on the radical side of the Muslims either. I don't agree with radical anything, actually.
Right.
I like it to be right in the middle. But how many people even know what the Noahide laws are? And in fact, that was it was Bush the Elder that signed him in, was it not?
Yes. Yes, he did. And, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I just wonder, again, why are all of these groups, the ones that talk about Sharia law, the ones that talk about, you know, all of these things, nobody's bringing this up. Do we have to write a manual for him, Deanna?
I think probably that's what it's going to take, but they're still going... Well, you have to either think that these people are either intellectually dishonest, that they are agent provocateurs, that they simply are too stupid to do their research, they work for an alphabet agency, because how many years have you been doing this research?
I'd probably say I started first hearing about something called the New World Order about 8 years ago, 10 years ago. And at first, I didn't believe it because I was just like everybody else. I thought that's ridiculous. And then I kept seeing it so much. So I would say off and on for 8 or 10 years. But I really got into it full time probably 4 years ago.
Okay, so it's taken you 4 years. Let's say 4 years. And you've gone down the rabbit hole deep enough to understand who's behind all the problems.
Right, right. And so I've been researching the whole Zionist thing for, I don't know, about a year or so. And I keep thinking, if people would have brought that up, if there would have been something where you can say, all right, this is a connection here, here, and here, look at the amount of time it would have saved.
Yeah, but look how short a time it took you to actually find this. When there are some people in the so-called truth movement who have been in the truth movement for years and years, and they still are clueless. They don't say the J word. Well, for instance, like the John Birch Society. You're never going to find anybody in that society that is ever going to really hit the nail on the, you know, use the hammer and hit the nail.
Right, and for a time, I thought G. Edward Griffin was really a good person to listen to. I listened to a lot of his things, till I found out that I believe he is a lifetime member of the John Birch Society.
I do know that he has spoken in their behalf, that they sponsor him. And, of course, anybody that they sponsor is not going to go outside of the wall, the safety wall, outside of the parameters.
Well, and I saw Oath Keepers were somehow, I don't know if they were just giving a recommendation about John Birch or what it was. And so I immediately thought, that's a little odd to me. I mean, do these people not know that it was originally sponsored by, I don't remember which one, but it was a Rockefeller that sponsored the Birch Society?
Well, I believe that Eustace Mullen said that it was, I think he talks about this in his book, Murder by Injection. But he doesn't supply a lot of a source material citation, but certainly they're not telling the truth. They're not divulging the entire truth. So, you know, somebody is certainly paying them to conceal it. And then when you tie them to the gold that was discovered in the Philippines, well, actually the Philippines, if you read Sterling, what is his name? He wrote Gold Warrior, Seagrave. Sterling and Peggy Seagrave wrote a book called Gold Warriors, and it talks about all of the confiscation of gold during. Starting as early as 1895 in Korea, but then going completely through to the end of World War II, that the Japanese went throughout Asia and confiscated gold, whether you're talking about state gold. They also went into private collections, into museums, and they basically seized much of the gold out of Asia, and then that gold was taken to Japan. But then when the American blockade sealed Japan off from the sea, so that they could not ships could not go into Japan during World War II, then a lot of that gold was placed in caverns in the Philippines. And so then you had Marcos involved in that, and the John Birch Society also was a benefactor of a very small amount of that gold. It's quite an interesting story, and I've had the Seagraves on my program maybe 6-7 months ago, but the book is fascinating.
I've never read that book. I do remember, and I can't hear again, I can't source it because I don't remember who said it, but they were talking about how China was so angry at us. We had sent gold over to China for some type of payment. When they tested it, they found that it was titanium covered with gold, because titanium has the same
weight,
yes. And that's what really brought up the fact of, is there any gold in Fort Knox? Have you heard about that?
Right. And I know that I believe that if you go to the City of London, you're going to find an awful lot of gold there. I do know that when America entered World War One, and even before, say 1913, as soon as the Federal Reserve was in place, America sent a lot of gold over to London, and it was to facilitate World War One. And you always have these big ships, whenever there's a war, you always have a lot of transportation of gold, and, you know, it's a movement of gold whenever you have a war. And just like the gold that was removed from the North Tower, from the vaults in the bottom of the North Tower, that was done a couple of days, a week before before 9/11. So who would have known whose gold was that? And then you had, you know, Building 7 that had the Securities Exchange Commission, which was supposedly investigating some of the shenanigans in the stock market. And you tie that into the crash in 1929, where you have the same people behind that. Bernard Baruch and all of his cronies were celebrating the night Black Tuesday with the 1929 crash. So you have all this movement of gold, and it usually occurs during warfare, because even now you have a lot of people who are really broke, who are really destitute, but they have some gold. I was in a jewelry store this past week to get my watch, a couple of my watches, new batteries, and the gentleman, I always go there, and he said, well, I just bought $6,000 worth of gold. And he showed me this canister full of bracelets and necklaces. And I said, my word, why would somebody sell all this gold? And he said, well, he said he's been buying a lot of gold lately because people are desperate. They don't have jobs. They don't have income. And so they're willing to give up stuff they've had for years.
Isn't that a shame?
Yeah.
But I have one question, and nobody's been able to answer this yet. Say you have some, say you've got some silver coins and you've got some gold. And all right, say we're in a state of entire financial collapse. And I don't know, you need to go fill your car up with gas. What are you actually going to do with that gold? Because you go over, you put gas in your car, do you really think that most of those stations are going to be able to make change for gold?
No.
See, I've never been able to figure that one out.
Right. I don't know. It you have to figure, you have to look at what happened in this, in a similar situation in another country whose currency absolutely fell totally so that it was worthless, and figure out what they did and who had gold. But like I said, during the war, these people that did have gold, who had gold in their families for years and years, it was all seized.
Isn't that? And you have to think, now that you're talking about gold, the movement of gold before wars, and God forbid they actually do get us into a war with Iran, does that mean that all of our gold is going to be moved out, or has it already been moved out, Deanna, and we just don't know it?
I don't think our gold is going to be moved out. I think, for instance, when we went, we didn't do this, okay? When the U.S. military went into Iraq and into Afghanistan, the very first thing they did in Iraq and Libya is that they took the gold. And so Bush went in, took the gold, and then Obama went in, the military seized all the gold. That is what they do in warfare. And then where it was moved to, who knows? But they certainly took the gold. Just like when they went into the Philippines in World War II and discovered all this gold in these caverns, they loaded it up and brought it to the city of London or somewhere in this country. But since you know, we don't know, and since there's no people have not gone in to audit the Fort Knox, then who knows where it went?
No, and I don't think there ever will be an audit of there, will there?
No.
I need to do some follow up on what China did after they discovered that it was titanium bars just covered with gold, besides having a fit. Because I don't know, and I never saw anything, a follow up afterwards. But it's certainly that's what got me wondering, do we actually have anything here anymore?
Somebody has somewhere. The American people, that's another story altogether.
There was a story in, I don't know, one of the London papers. I saw it just about a week or two ago, and it was talking about that London was bragging that they had so much gold, and they were showing a big room with just bars upon bars on it. And somebody was doing kind of an analysis of the article, and they said, well, that's not all of England's gold. They're keeping it for so many countries.
Right.
You know, and of course, in the city of London. So I don't know. My best guess would be that's where it's ending up.
Well, Germany recently approached the U.S. government and said, we want to have an inventory of our gold. So somehow there's something going on regarding us having confiscated or are the custodial overseers of their gold, which I find kind of interesting. Well, because Germany is an occupied country. Every country that has U.S. military bases in are occupied because following World War II, the United States government became the world's dictator. And
okay.
So we, for instance, when, I don't want to say we, when the United States government went into Iraq, they built at least 14 military bases to oversee the assets of that country. When they went into Afghanistan, of course, they restored the poppy agriculture, so that the international drug trade could continue to function after the Taliban had shut it down. So you have that going on, and somebody's making a lot of money. And in order for people to make that money and to be able to control a country that the United States military has invaded, they have to have bases. You still have bases in Germany. You still have bases in Japan. You still have bases in Korea. Now you've got them in Afghanistan. You've got them in Iraq. You know, we have them all over the world.
It's amazing we have any military left on U.S. soil, isn't it?
Yes. Well, they have shut down a lot of bases here because, quite frankly, the American people are so apathetic and ignorant. They have no idea. They don't need to be forced to be obedient and render, you know, and just do what they're told, because we just do automatically because we have been trained to respect authority.
Well, yes, I think we've been trained to respect authority, but what about the normal person's curiosity or the normal person's, I mean, Americans are just not acting normally now. They're not. When you look at the other countries, look at the riots, what, a year or two ago.
Right. And we used to riot. This country used to riot all the time.
Oh, absolutely. And how long has it been since you've seen? I can't remember. Well, what, I would guess I would have to say like maybe the Rodney King riots or something. Or even protests.
The Watts riots. But look what television has done to indoctrinate us to fear the police. Look, I mean, if you really watch some of those weekly programs, the cop shows, CSI, and some of the other programs, and you see the police knocking down doors. Well, you even see that on the news. You see the police knocking down doors, rushing in, dressed in black with, you know, these SWAT teams. We are so intimidated by authority that we don't riot. Now, during the administration of Andrew Jackson, oh my goodness, there were so many riots during that administration. Just in 1935 alone, there were a lot of riots because people were mad. They were mad about what he was doing, and so he sent in the military. And you know, and quash those riots. You also had some riots. Let's see, in 1922 in Utah, and Rockefeller sent in the U.S. military. And you know, they use the military. Well, even the Pullum company, the riots then. I'm trying to remember exactly what the Pullman strike. Yeah, the Pullman strike. When you look at the Pullman strike, you find that the corporations have used the U.S. military to do their bidding and to quash the riots, so that people have learned that you just have to accommodate you know, the corporations. It's a terrible thing. I mean, it's a terrible thing, but the people in other countries are not as indoctrinated.
No, they're not as brainwashed.
Yeah. It was a Pullman strike they used a Pinkerton agency. It was under the President Grover Cleveland in 1894. Grover Cleveland sent 12,000 troops to Chicago. The Illinois governor didn't even ask for it. The president just automatically, as soon as that Pullman strike started on May 11th, they sent them in.
Well, and people talk about the radicalization of our police departments and the military. Who's training them?
The Israelis.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, what the heck? That really irritates me.
Yeah.
Why should, and how many people talk about that?
Well, they don't talk about it because then you'd have to actually get down to brass tacks. Like the Ludlow Massacre, which is 1914. Uniformed employees killed at least 24 striking coal miners, in addition to two women and 11 children. And it was the Rockefellers who sent these people, who sent the the force in, the military force, because they owned CF&I and the Rocky Mountain Fuel Company. And these miners were striking, and so that's how they handled it.
Yeah, anytime there's an uprising, they're there to quash it very quickly. But the thing, and I'm not advocating rioting by a long shot, but I am, you know, some protesting. Although, really, I think it's gotten to the point, Deanna, where I don't know if protesting, I don't think it would do any good at this time. Except
well,
that it would show that if people are actually awake and care, that
right.
it would show.
Well, I was part of an anti-war protest in downtown Chicago 5-6 years ago, and the media didn't even cover it, and there was at least 5,000 people down there.
Really? No, I've never even heard of it.
Right, and you know who the media covered? Let's see, who did they cover? There were 7 people down there that were pro-war, and that's who they talked to. That's who they interviewed. And we saw that night on the TV that they were interviewing these pro-war people. Did not show. Didn't show the crowds of people marching. I think we marched for 10 blocks, 11 blocks. I don't know. We had signs. I had 9/11 signs. And it was I think there were probably more than 5,000 people because they were busing them in from the suburbs. The group that I was associated with met at a church, and there must have been 10 or 12 buses just leaving from that church. And I know that there were other churches that did likewise. And of course, most of the churches in the Chicago suburbs, because of their association and their affiliation with Christian Zionism, probably didn't know anything about the march and probably wouldn't have participated if they had.
All those Christian Zionists. When I started looking into that, and you've got people like John Hagee, who says God bless Israel before he says God bless America. I'd like to just, what I'd like to tell that man off. And these people that are openly in the streets with, I was surprised to see a lot of the gatherings because I didn't see it on the news. And that was thank goodness for YouTube videos, where they get together in New York, and all you see are Israeli flags. I mean, what is wrong with these people? Do they have a brain cell that's actually functioning?
Probably they just are so... Well, you're talking about something that's very close emotionally to people's heart, and that is their religion, and they just can't imagine that somebody that's supposed to represent God would be lying to them, out and out just lying to them. And then you have other people, infiltrators into the truth movement, which you've talked about disinformation, misinformation, and even as early as 2009, there were people who were exposing Alex Jones and his background. And we know that he's married to a Jewess, but on one site that's called outlawjournalism.com, it goes into Alex Jones' biography and genealogy, and it states on this website that Alex Jones is a descendant of a wealthy politician, Anson Jones, who was born in 1798, died in 1858 in Houston. He was a dentist. He was a congressman. He was the last president of the Republic of Texas from 1844 to 1846. He was apparently the son of Solomon Jones and Sarah Strong. He was a member of the Masonic Grand Lodge of Texas, a member of the Holland Society, Grandmaster, and the Harmony Lodge of Philadelphia. And Alex Jones... those were his ancestors. And it indicates here, I'm just kind of reading here. Let's see. Mary Smith Jones, wife of Anson Jones, was apparently Jewish. And So he does have a Jewish line. Kelly Rebecca Nichols. Let's see, who is she? She was
his wife.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I've seen that as well. They. I know Brother Nathaniel's got three links up on his site, as to the Alex Jones's connections. We'll say.
Right. He was, I think, one of the first people that. That actually exposed this this background.
Right, and I know I've for the people that have wondered why Occupy Corporatism and Suzanne Posel have, a lot of people have wondered why she had this meteoric rise to fame in just the last 8-10 months, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some of this up on my website on my. This info page on here. And what really got me interested was somebody on Facebook had written a great article, and it was called Is Occupy Corporatism Suzanne Posel a disinformation agent? And it's well worth a look to find that link there again is on my page. Besides the amount of articles that she writes alone, I know you're a prolific writer, Deanna. I know that just by your amount of books and the articles you put up.
But
how can somebody do 4 articles a day?
You can't. I have not really written an article for months. It's all I can do. Most of my articles were written before 2009. I think I've written 2 since then because I've been working on my books. And right now I'm working on my books and I'm doing my daily radio program. That's all I can handle.
Just for instance, because you did such a good job on the USS Liberty article that you wrote about it being a false flag.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for a fact, well, I don't know positively, but I'm sure you're going to agree with me. There is no way you could have written that article in one day.
Of course not. I wrote another article. It's called... It's called False Flags for Israel. Actually, it was not an article. I put it together to present on 9/11 of this year, 2012, 9/11. And what I did was incorporate a lot of information that I had written about previously. And like I say, it was called False Flags for Israel. It was 25 pages long, 11,000 words, 11,195 words. And, I just incorporated a lot of the research that I had previously done for my books, beginning with the Lusitania in World War I and the tactic of live bait, which I compared to the live bait situation in 9/11. Anytime that you kill Americans, you're going to have the American population outraged at whoever you're going to say did it. For instance, Winston Churchill said, "Oh, the Germans! You know, the Germans hit the Lusitania and killed all these Americans, so everybody's going to hate the Germans." But this is just something that I put together for that program, 9/11, and then afterwards, I went ahead and uploaded it to my website on that date on my schedule page. But that's really the last compilation that I have done because I am working on book 3. So, you can only do so much. And honestly, in-depth research takes a lot of time. You cannot just pen out an article a day. It's just not possible.
Well, let alone 3 or 4 of them. That's one of the reasons, and I know several other people have started looking into what was really behind Occupy Corporatism, because when you're shooting out 3 and 4 articles, and so many of the alternative media, thanks to Alex Jones' connection with Occupy Corporatism early on, their hits have just really grown on there. And what I found, which I think is pretty interesting to me, there again on that, the Facebook page that's asked if Occupy Corporatism is a disinformation agent. in part of it, it says, quote, David Posel, who is Suzanne's husband, presents himself as head of marketing firm Green Buddha Group and head of CEO Association of North America. Well, being the curious person that I am, I started looking for the Green Buddha Group, and I only found one link to it, which was on Google, and now it's gone. But thank goodness I was able to get a screenshot of it. And now this is all up on my disinfo page on my website. And it clearly shows a man's hand and a Green Buddha. And it says David J. Posel, CEO, Green Buddha Group in Beaverton, Oregon. Well, also on his Green Buddha Facebook page, on the About section, it gives the phone number of the Green Buddha Group. And just to make positive, because I don't want to inaccurately, you know, say anything about anybody that I can't back up to the best of my knowledge, I found a scribd document. And it was titled Infowars.com Hit Piece on Occupy Corporatism. Well, on one of the emails of that was supposedly, I believe, from Suzanne Posel to someone in Infowars, it gives the same phone number that is on the Green Buddha Group, the exact same phone number. So there we've got this big connection. All right, now this is what's going on with it that I could find. So we've now got David Posel is the head of, as the CEO of the Green Buddha Group. And on the bottom of one of the Green Buddha Group's pages, and again, I've got a screenshot of it, it says, our partner is Eagle Television. And it gives a 5 or 6 line description of what Eagle Television covers. And it's no small thing, for it says this includes 20 ABC affiliates, 13 NBC stations, 8 CBS affiliates, one MyTV station, and one Fox affiliate. So now you've got connections into the mainstream media, yes? Well, when I looked up who owned Eagle Television, it is the Katz Media Group. And there again, their description, when you look at the Eagle Television, is exactly the same as Green Buddha Group, with the exception in Green Buddha Group, it says they have 43 major television stations, and in Katz Media, it has 53. Other than that, they're identical as far as I can see. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. Who owns the Katz Media Group? In 2000, from their own website, on their timeline, they became a part of the Clear Channel family. And the Clear Channel family, as far as I can tell, from several different websites, it says that Art Bell and George Norrie's Coast to Coast show is syndicated by Clear Channel. One of them is saying, from wingtv.net, it says, quote, first regarding GCN, which is Genesis Communication, which is on Alex Jones' show is on, first regarding GCN's affiliation with ABC and Clear Channel. GCN and ABC stamped on one of their network streams and Clear Channel on another. Recently, these headings have been stripped off their schedule page and removed, but it says GCN is not only an ABC affiliate, but a Clear Channel affiliate as well. So now you've got a tie-in with Alex Jones and the whole GCN network. But this is probably the most amazing of them all. This was from the Story Behind the Story website. And it's entitled Glenn Beck, Limbaugh, and Hannity, Mana from Heaven. And it talks about how Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, and Rush Limbaugh are broadcast from the Premier Network, radio network. And who owns the Premier radio network is the Clear Channel. And who owns the Clear Channel but Bain Capital? And, of course, everybody's going to remember that if they read the articles, I don't know how far out this was broadcast. I know you know this, Deanna, about Mitt Romney and his affiliation with Bain Capital. And then, of course, you've got his connections with Benjamin Netanyahu, that they used to work together at a Boston consulting group. So now what you've got, just kind of to recap, oh, I'm sorry, I left out one of the most important people. The head of Bain Capital is Miss Orit Gadish. And I will quote part of the article from in the story behind the story. Of course you know Bain Capital, the home company of Willard Mittens Romney. But who runs Bain, and more importantly, where does Bain Capital get its capital? Ms. Orit Gadish and Company and the international banking cartel of the Edomite elite, the biblical, quote, synagogue of Satan. Who is Orit Gadish? Merely the daughter of one of the key figures of the Israeli crime syndicate called the Mossad, a.k.a. the Israeli Defense Forces. Ms. Gadish is no lightweight bimbo. And then it gives a link on there, and it says to read about Ms. Gadish's role in the rise of Red China as a financial giant, among other eye-raising topics. So I found the whole thing that very interesting, that the website Occupy Corporatism can be connected through David Posel's Green Buddha Group to Eagle Television, Katz Media, Clear Channel, and to Bain Capital.
Wow. Wow. Yes.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. I mean, I tell you, go ahead, and then I keep talking. You've definitely connected all those dots, and certainly I didn't think about doing that. You know, I saw that she had a program on RBN, and I looked at the website, and I read one of her articles, and I thought, wow, she'd probably be a pretty good guest, without even doing any background. Now, I never had her on my program, but I did talk to her, and then I just, you know, I talked to people, and I get gut feelings, and then I just didn't follow through.
Well, Katz Media in and of itself is very, when you start looking, it's well worth a time for anybody to start looking up the Katz Media channel and see how powerful they are. Because they are, and they handle TV, radio, digital promotions, and they are huge. They've been in business since, I think, the late 1800s. And so this is quite it's quite a connection, Deanna. I was quite amazed when it actually went all the way up to Bain Capital and then Orit Gadish, because...
Yeah.
You know, just before the election, they were talking about, I think it was Tex Mars. I hope I'm right on that. But a lot of people were talking about, is Orit Gadish the handler, the Israeli handler of Mitt Romney?
Yeah.
And she was, just a little bit of background about her. I mean, she served, obviously, as all Israelis do, I think a couple of years in the IDF. She cut her teeth in the Israeli war room with, what is his name? The one who, Moshe Dayan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow.
Was he not the one that called the hit on the USS Liberty?
Possibly. I would have to look that up. Hang on, I'll just look it up. I will... check that out.
I think he, in looking at some of these articles about this, while you're looking that up, I'll just read a little bit of background about Ms. Gadish. It says, Orit Gadish, born in Israel in 1951, has worked closely with Mitt Romney since at least 1993. Romney appointed Gadish to his transition team when he became governor of Massachusetts. So she's kind of followed Romney around in his career, and of course she's a CEO and head of Bain Capital right now, and a lot of people have declared her one of the most important women in the world.
Yikes. My goodness. You know, the problem with some names is that particularly foreign names, is that you don't know how to spell them.
What, Gadie? Yeah. G-A-D.
I'm looking at Moise Dayan. Dayan.
Oh, I'm sorry. D-O-Y-A-N, right? D-O-Y-A-N, I think is.
See, that's.
I think that's what it was. No?
Nope.
And you're right. It is hard to look him up sometimes when you don't
know
how to spell.
Yeah, I've written about him. I just don't remember how to spell it.
I've got an article on my page where it's more articles about Ms. Gadish. And I know in one of them, because that's where I had read about the Liberty.
It's Dayan, and it's Moise. Okay. Moish, M-O-S-H-E. So now that we have that, let me, he died in 1981. Let me just search for him in my articles. And yes, I wrote about him in We're Not Going to War Over a Bunch of Dead Sailors.
Okay, I just found the source where I had... where I had read that, and this is off Veterans Today, and it was by Kevin Barrett. It says, "Is this myth's shameful secret? Bain is a Mossad agent."
Wow.
And they're talking about Bain Capital, of course.
Right.
And now I just scrolled up and lost. Here it is. Okay. They're talking about Ms. Gadish, and it said she also worked in the war room. A bunker where General Moise Dayan, who ruthlessly ordered the sneak attack on the USS Liberty, killing and maiming defenseless American soldiers and Marines, was in charge.
Right. And Peter Hoonan talks about this in Operation Cyanide, why the bombing of the USS Liberty nearly caused World War III, and he did direct that attack. Excuse me. He did direct that attack.
So these are some amazing connections. When I started looking this up, I quite honestly never thought I would find anything even close to this.
Right.
But yeah. I just wonder is somebody feeding her articles? I don't know.
Yes, I'm not sure how old she is. I do know that. When you have small children, I just don't. I got a lot done when I had small children, but I wasn't writing articles. I mean, I was baking cookies and doing a lot of things that had nothing whatsoever to do with in-depth research.
Well, I think that the thing that bothered me too is when I look at Katz Media, and another thing I've got to put up on my website that I didn't mention right now is that I had found a lot of the upper management of Katz Media has come out of the Bernard Baruch College.
Oh my.
And I'm going to let you tell you know his history. I mean, I know some of it, but I know you're an expert on that.
Well, yeah. I think there's also another expert on this, Dick Eastman, who did a fabulous job at outlining Bernard Baruch. But Bernard Baruch he influenced President Wilson, through Eisenhower. In fact, he is the guy that really promoted Eisenhower and put him in a situation where he would be the leader of the European operation during World War II. And then, of course, when he got back, he was promoted as this great big huge war hero, and a lot of presidents do have that persona, including Andrew Jackson. He was promoted as a war hero. But yeah, Bernard Baruch was the one that actually targeted Germany. He said, "We're not going to let Hitler get away with it. We're going to lick that fella." And he was talking about Hitler's European or his economic program. And so Bernard Baruch was also in charge of buying all of the armaments and that sort of thing. For World War One, he was in charge of, what was he in charge of? Let's see. He was basically promoted the idea that you could make money through warfare. He is also the person that promoted a one world order. And he was in charge of, hang on, let me just bring up his name so I can tell you what agency he was in charge of.
Wasn't he also called one of the fathers of Zionism?
No, he was not. That was not one of his labels. But he was let's see, Paul. He was a partner with Eugene Meyer and the Alaska Juneau Gold Mining Company. In 1890, he was working on Wall Street and with his brothers. He was associated with Harriman, Schiff, and all those people. He was in charge of the company that really took over the U.S. economy during World War One, and he was, in fact, he actually admitted that, he was in charge of the U.S. War Industries Board, which President Wilson established on July 28, 1917, and he was the chairman of it. And he said, "I actually became a virtual dictator." And he was in charge of buying all the ships and taking care of all of the production during World War One, and he made a lot of money. He was making he made $50 million during World War One.
Well, the ones, and I only looked really at three or four people. It says James E. and I'm going to murder this last name, Beloynus. You know, I really, it's Beloyianis, is secretary of Katz Media Group and president of Katz Media Corporation. He got a master's degree from Zicklin School of Business, which is from Baruch College. Dave Hauptman, vice president of Continental Sales, Television Sales, which is a division of Katz Television Group. He got an MBA from Bernard Baruch College.
Wow.
Sharon Chandra, former human resources assistant at Katz Media Group, who is currently a senior analyst of Federal Reserve New York, received an MBA and a BA from Bernard Baruch College. And this is the one that I found interesting. Thomas Olson, president and director of Katz Media Group, Inc., is also a board member of Sea Change International. And this is, I thought this was interesting. Director and member of Corporation Governance of Sea Channel International is Carlo Salvatore, who is also chairman of Lazard and Company, SRI, which is a subsidiary of Lazard Group, LLC.
Right.
So do you think they've got some powerful connections there, Deanna?
Oh, sure. And, you know, getting back to Bernard Baruch, Wilson actually relinquished all economic control of the government to three of his financial backers, all Jews, Eugene I. Meyer, Paul Warburg, and Bernard Baruch. And under Roosevelt, in 1933, when the government was collecting, seizing everybody's gold, Bernard Baruch was allowed to keep all of his.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was kind of amazing because I would just think that Baruch College would have the same
mentality, sure.
Yes, yes. You know, it has to trickle down somewhere, I would think.
Sure.
You know, they say don't ever assume anything, but...
You have to assume because they work from generation to generation. These people pass it on. They expect to be doing that. They expect to pass it on, and they recognize that they can't do it all in one generation.
And then you have Carlo Salvatore, who's chairman of Lazard & Company, that's connected with the president and director of Katz Media Group.
Mm-hmm.
So Katz Media is really, it's a very interesting, and it is so powerful. I mean, I will send you some of my links to it so you can look some of this up, Deanna, because I think you'll find it kind of eye-opening how powerful they are. And then when you look at the fact that they've got all of these affiliations with ABC, NBC, and CBS, and then it comes right up to... with Bain Capital owning Clear Channel, and you've got Orit Gadish, the head of Bain Capital. What is that? I mean, talk about press control.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, at any rate, I thought that was kind of...
And speaking of the press, Eugene I. Meyer, who directed the War Finance Corporation during World War One, his daughter was Catherine Graham, who later became head of the newspaper, the Washington Post. The Washington Post. She owned the Washington Post. And Meyer went on to become the chairman of the Federal Reserve from 1930 to 1933. Then after that, he became the head of the World Bank. I mean, so when he, and he started out, 30 years before, being a big shot in World War One, and after World War II, President Harry Truman, a Freemason, going back to the Masonic Associations, appointed Mayer Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, as the first head of the World Bank in June 1946.
I think there's a little nepotism going on there, Deanna.
Indeed.
And getting back to the protocols where we started, it most definitely, in at least three or four sections, talks about controlling the press.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what more do people, truly, if I had to pick one thing, if people asked me what to read to get up to speed on all of this, I would have to say it is the protocols, without a doubt.
Yes, indeed. Which is a good way, a roundabout way of coming right back to the protocols. And if people do that and then incorporate what is going on or compare the protocols to what is going on today and what has gone on in the last more than 100 years, they have a pretty good roadmap.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember in college, I majored in history. And... nothing. I might as well have taken that money and thrown it down the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had never heard of all of this. And it's kind of history 101. And
right.
I think it's basic for anyone that wants to know what's really going on. And for people that aren't talking about this, especially in the alternative media, they're doing everybody a great disservice by not bringing these, how comparable things are to these protocols.
Right. Well, that's why we have people like you. That's why we need more people like you to write articles, to bring this up, and to connect the dots for those who refuse to or just haven't the gray matter to do that.
Well, I know it was certainly an eye-opener for me, and I don't know how long you've been studying all of this about Zionism. From your wealth of knowledge, it has to be years and years, I would assume.
No. When I was a young mother, I joined the John Birch Society because I knew something was wrong. I read Gary Allen's book. What was the name of his book?
None Dare
None
Call It
Dare Call. Yeah.
I'll call it Conspiracy, I think.
Yeah, that was it. And then I joined the. I thought I got to do something. I can't. You know, I have to get involved somehow. I joined the John Birch Society. And the only thing I heard them say, "Oh, we got to get out of the UN. We got to get out of the UN."
Well,
and
that they were right.
They were absolutely right, but nothing ever happened. It just seemed like it was the society was designed to go nowhere. I mean,
that's called controlled opposition, isn't it?
Yeah, and I really did not start into this this current interest field of mine till 2005.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really. Not even 10 years.
It's just, well, you've covered a lot of area in that amount of time. I mean, I can tell by, and I've heard you say often how much you love history, and that is so key. You know, I don't know who quoted the phrase that people who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. Maybe you know who coined that, but I don't. But whoever it was never spoke
Santana.
True words.
I think it was Santana. George.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds like something he would say.
I mean, it is no wonder they don't want anybody knowing the real history.
Yep, because then you are going to be making too many comparisons. Yes, George Santayana said it. I knew I pronounced it incorrectly. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Yep.
And it is, it becomes so clear when you start looking at this.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, it is so sad. They're taking away our American heritage. And I was talking with a friend the other day, Deanna, and I thought, you know, I so long for the innocent times of America, where you would go out and your biggest problem was to be, let's go for a summertime picnic and go out and just sit and relax and enjoy nature and not have to worry about this type of thing. And I realized they're taking away not only our lives, but our happiness.
Right.
You know.
And of course, those times when you could go out and lay on the grass and look up at the clouds and figure out what the clouds look like, we were young and definitely innocent, and we were just products of our environment, just the same as people are now. But the innocence is gone. When you turn on TV and you see a sex scene during prime time, you know that things have disintegrated terribly, just absolutely terribly.
I haven't watched TV. I disconnected my cable over 3 years ago. So the only time I see it a little bit is if I go to someone's house who has cable. And truly, it so irritates me that I'd like to put my foot through the screen.
Right. Yeah. We got rid of our TV when our children were little, and we didn't have one for 7 or 8 years because it was just we just didn't want them under that kind of influence. And then we caved into child pressure, because kids, they want to keep up with the kids at school, and yeah, I don't watch a lot of TV. I would prefer to read, but
yeah, it takes you on it. Not only does it mesmerize you, as they say, so they can do subliminal images.
Right.
You're not thinking about it. And the trash that comes on anymore is just, it is unbelievable that is on main TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and since it's Christmas time, remember when we used to have nice Christmas specials on all the time?
Mm-hmm.
You never see those anymore, do you?
No, you actually have to search for them, and if I were by myself, I would not have a TV. But
I know I don't miss it.
Right.
And
well,
I
I certainly
don't.
wouldn't.
And the outrageous amount you have to pay to for unbelievably bad TV is not worth it. So.
Right. Indeed. Well, it has been absolutely lovely visiting with you. We've certainly caught up with the absence of us not talking for a while. We've made up for that today.
And it was great talking with you, Deanna. It's always a pleasure. I always learn a lot from you. I feel like talking with you is like, you know, the student talking with the teacher.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Goodness.
In a lot of this. And I have to tell everybody, because we don't say happy holidays, we say Merry Christmas. So Merry Christmas to anyone listening to this.
And Merry Christmas to you, and Merry Christmas to the listeners.
Yes, and to you too, Deanna. It's been great, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Me too. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Deanna.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.